me to continue to work for that ideal Vermont and for a strong economy.
Paid for by the Cummings for Senate Committee.
It's time to get the story behind the story. Interviews with newsmakers, newsbreakers, and your phone calls. Radio Vermont presents The Mark Johnson Show.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the program. Thanks for tuning in. Another lovely day out there today. Thanks for spending part of it with us. Coming up on the program in just a moment here, we're going to be chatting with Tom Baudette, the voice of Motel 6. Coming up later on in the program at about 10:15 this morning, we're going to preview an event coming up this weekend, the Button Up Vermont events. This is an encouragement for you to get out there and try to get your home prepared for the winter. Then, of course, you prepare yourself for the winter. It's kind of like, you know, when you're on the plane with the oxygen, you take care of the house and then you take care of, well, no, you're supposed to take care of yourself on the plane. That's right. Sorry, got that one backward. All right, love to hear from you. See, already in trouble, not even a minute into the program, already in trouble today. You can reach us today at 244-1777. That's our local number in Central Vermont. Toll free, you can reach us at 877-291-8255. Coming up on Saturday at the Flynn Theater, there's going to be a storytelling event. And joining us live on the line this morning to talk about that is Tom Baudette, who joins us from Southern Vermont. Tom, thanks for joining us. How are you?
Hey, Mark, thanks so much for having me.
So how did you get the Motel 6 job?
Well, you know those scratch-off tickets that you get at the Sunoco stations and stuff?
Yeah.
You know, it was just like, it was like that, you know. I just walked into a Sunoco station in 1987, and it says, you are now the spokesperson for a major motel brand.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah, I know, but it is. I literally won the lottery. That's not the answer you wanted, is it?
No.
No.
I'll just sit here and wait in silence.
I'm in radio, too, Mark. I'm used to killing time, you see.
Mm-hmm.
No, what actually happened was I was a commentator for public radio, their evening news program, All Things Considered. I was living in Alaska and sending these goofy little stories down once a week to NPR. And there was an advertising guy down in Dallas by the name of David Fowler, who was hearing me there. And then when the Motel 6 account came onto his desk, he put two and two together, or at least one and two, and got six. So, and we lived happily ever after.
Why do you think it works so well? It's so memorable.
Well, I'll tell you why I think it works. And I know this for sure because they told me why they think it works.
Okay.
When about 2-3 years into the radio campaign, which hasn't changed a lot over the last 27 years. We keep doing new stories, but it's the same message, same guy, same tagline. We'll leave the light on for you. And a couple of years into it, they thought, well, maybe they should start doing some television rather than just radio.
Uh-huh.
But before they put me on camera, they wanted to make sure they weren't going to screw anything up. And now, bear in mind, at the time, I was like 33 years old. And so they did some focus groups, and they asked people questions about what they thought I was like. You know, how old was I? You know, what I look like? What kind of car did I drive? All this kind of stuff. And what they found out is people tended to think I was like them. If they were 60, they thought I was 60. If they were 40, they thought I was 40. And if they were heavy, they thought I was heavy. Tall, they thought I was tall. It was like that. So that explains why you've never seen me on television. And that explains, I think, why it works. Is the way I put it is I'm like the generic American, you
wow.
know?
You're like every man.
Right, something like that.
Wow.
Yeah, every man, only without any of the sort of heroism and things.
Yeah, it was sort of a bummer. They actually put your picture in the Free Press when they did this story about the event coming up at the Flynn, so it probably blew a lot of people's image of what you actually look like.
Well, what I'm finding is the older I get, the less surprised people are.
Mm-hmm.
I think I can finally come out, you know. But I tell you, when I showed up, you know, at 35 with a mullet, his head's exploded, you know.
What were you doing living out in Alaska?
Well, I went up there when I was very young. I was 21 years old. I hitchhiked out west to find some adventure, taking a little break from college. I was going to Michigan State University. I'm still on that break, by the way. And I got up there, and I just got caught up in it. I did all the one-syllable jobs. You know, I logged, I fished, I built. Ended up being a independent house builder for 8 years or so, and then found my way back to writing and radio, and off we go. Although I have to say, just like, you know, I described that lottery ticket, my career feels like that to me sometimes, and I still have a whole garage full of tools just in case all of this goes away.
Mm, okay, that's handy. Yeah, I kind of feel like I've won the life lottery, but it sounds like you do too.
Yeah, well, it's nice to feel that way.
You didn't in Alaska. You didn't go quite into the wild in kind of a John Krakauer kind of way, did you?
No, I mean, I wasn't that brave. I spent enough time outdoor. I was never a great outdoorsman, but the thing about Alaska is you can't avoid it.
You know? Yeah.
I mean, the outdoors in Alaska just kind of comes and gets you. You know, there's like more wilderness per capita in Alaska than any other state. There's all kinds of crazy things about it. And it's a little different than, like, in Vermont, which we've lived here now for, I think this is our 11th year here, and we love it here.
Oh, you just got here.
Well, yeah, I know. I'm still a newcomer. We're not even completely unpacked yet. I'm still finding those little stickers on my furniture as we move it around. But we, you know, we came here from out west, and I grew up in Michigan, like I said, and Vermont is sort of Michigan if you kind of crumpled it up. It's all the same. It's like the same flora and fauna and, you know, like the critters in the woods and the smells of the leaves and the trees and all that is what I grew up with. So there's something very, very familiar about it and peaceful, really, which suits me in my older age, if you will, at least my rapidly advancing middle age, as opposed to Alaska, which was truly intense, you know, like you leave the road there and you gotta pay attention to what you're doing. And Vermont, yeah, of course you do too. And one of the reasons I'm involved with the Vermont State Parks is because Vermont has a lot of wonderful, amazing outdoor vistas and adventures to go on, and our parks are the place to do that. Vermont is a much smaller state than Alaska. If I needed to point that out, this is why you called me, right? Because I'm full of these interesting little facts. And you know, to really experience Vermont, maybe as the pioneers did, maybe even as the Native Americans did. There's only a few places you can do that, and many of those places are in the Vermont State Park. And when I was invited to serve on the board of the Vermont Parks Forever, which is this private foundation that we're raising money for on Saturday night, which supports the mission of the parks. I mean, I was all in. I'm all in on this.
Nice job. You got to the sponsor of the event before I did. That was good. Nice job. And if Vermont is Michigan scrunched up, then Alaska would be Michigan, like, expanded out, maybe?
Yeah, no, actually, Alaska is as far away as you can get from Michigan without owning a passport, and that's kind of how I ended up there. At that time in my life, I needed some distance, let's say, from my humble beginnings.
Tom Baudette is part of a group that's putting on an event coming up on Saturday night at the Flint Theater in Burlington. It's called The Hatch, and it's a storytelling event. So, Tom, let's talk about that event. Why is it called The Hatch?
Well, that was just kind of a random title. We had to call it something. The way we conceived is I've been involved with The Moth, which is the, you know, this national storytelling organization that has a radio program, and they host events all over the country, and I've done a few of their events with them. And it started off with I invited them to come to Brattleboro to do a fundraising show for us, a charity show to raise money for our local Latches Theater. And they very graciously explained that they are a nonprofit themselves, and all of the money that they are able to raise at their events goes back into their mission, which is to advance the, you know, the art and craft of storytelling. So I thought, well, how about if we just did a storytelling show and invited all these same storytellers that do The Moth to do our show, and the only difference is we'll just give the money away to whoever it is that we're partnered with. The very first one, as I said, was for the Latches Theater renovation. That went well. We did another one for New England Youth Theater, another great organization down here in Brattleboro. And then in the spring, we did our third one for the Morningside Shelter, which is our area homeless shelter, which does a terrific job. And we raised over $35,000 for their 35th anniversary.
That's some serious money.
It is in a small town, isn't it?
Yeah.
And then when it came up, when I got involved with Vermont Parks Forever, and we realized that, you know, we needed some kind of a coming out ceremony, if you will, to announce to people that we're here. We're a startup foundation. We've got a terrific board, and we wanted some very fun, unique way to announce our arrival. And it's the 90th anniversary of the Vermont State Park System. And so we set a goal of let's raise $90,000. So how are we going to do that? Well, we do it by fundraising in the old-fashioned ways, which is calling all of our friends and neighbors and people who want to be associated with a good cause like this. And then we rent a theater like the Flynn, which holds 1,400 people, and we charge money for people to come and listen to stories. The way I look at it is, you know how if you're a member of VPR, you know, Vermont Public Radio, you know, you get that satisfaction of helping out a good cause, and maybe you get a mug and a tote bag.
Uh-huh.
Well, this show is kind of the mug and the tote bag you get.
Okay. No lead in those mugs.
Lead in those mugs. Yeah. And if you, you know, and we're charging a good price for our seats. The reason being that this money is all going to be passed through to the foundation.
Okay.
We've already raised $65,000 in sponsorships. If we sell the Flynn out as we hope to do, we'll reach our goal of $90,000, and it will get Vermont Parks Forever off to a wonderful start.
FlynnTix.org, is that how you get tickets?
Yep, FlynnTix.org.
244-1777 is our local number, toll-free 877-291-8255. Well, we'll talk more about the event in a moment, but I want you to tell me, what was the scariest thing that happened to you in Alaska?
Oh, geez. Thankfully, I've blacked out the really horrific stuff. most of the scariest stuff in Alaska in the 70s and 80s happened indoors. Let's just leave that there.
Okay. How about outdoors?
Well, outdoors, you know, there's nothing scarier, although I wasn't hurt or probably even in danger, there's nothing scarier than being lost. Even, and I love this quote, even Daniel Boone, like the original, you know, pioneer hero, when asked if he was ever lost, said that, no, he can't say he was ever lost, but I was bewildered once for 3 or 4 days.
Yeah.
And I once went deer hunting with two friends on this island in southeast Alaska, which was near where I was living at the time, called Vank Island. It was a mile long and not even a half a mile wide, and it was just a dome.
How do you get lost on an island that
small?
Well,
you know how you do it, Mark? You follow me. I went wandering around. We set up camp on the beach, and I went way up on top. And it was like southeast Alaska is nothing but a fog bank and a rainstorm pretty much, you know, half the year. And that's what that day was. And I went up to the top of the hill and got disoriented. I have no sense of direction at all. And the only way I'm able to live with that is the fact that they say that a poor sense of direction is a sign of genius.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And also poor handwriting is supposed to be another sign of genius.
So you're like a double genius?
Well, I've got those two things going for me. The third thing is, though, is you actually be a genius. So, I mean, 2 out of 3 isn't bad.
Right.
So I got turned around on top of this island and said, well, I mean, how bad can it be? It's not very big, so I'll just walk downhill until I hit the ocean again, and then I'll go left or right, and I'll make my way back to camp. So I did that. I went down to the ocean and didn't recognize anything, so I went left. And climbing over boulders and rubble and logs and this stuff. And about 6 hours later, I make it back to camp, which was about 100 feet to the right of where I came out of the woods.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, so, but I have, and during that time, I mean, if anybody who's listening to this who's ever been lost, even for a few minutes where you kind of, you're out and you lose your landmark or whatever it is, and you realize for a few minutes that you don't know where you are, it is panic-making.
Yeah.
I mean, it is the most nerve-wracking thing that you can be in, other than actually being dragged through the woods by a bear, probably.
Yeah, the only other experience that I've had like that is when the first couple of times I lost track of my kid in a store.
There it is. It's almost that same feeling. What it is your kid is lost. You just project all that same panic onto that experience. You're right.
Yeah. I mean, it's like you're almost disconnected from the spaceship, you know, and you're out on a spacewalk. So why did you move to Vermont?
Well, that's a weird triangulation of family and geography. I have a good friend here, Will Ackerman, who's the Windham Hill Records guy and guitarist. And I've known Will for a lot of years. We did some work together back in the early 90s. And I used to come out and visit Will once a year or so when I was in Alaska, whenever my business brought me to the East Coast. And when my wife, Rita, got pregnant with who now our 11-year-old son, she started to feel very far away from her family when we were out west. Her family's all in the New York City area and down in Florida. And so, long story short, in some weird navigational equation, Vermont is halfway between Alaska and New York City. How's that?
Oh, boy, you won that argument. Yeah,
right.
That's good.
It's as far away from her family as she was willing to be and as close to New York as I was willing to be.
And you can do your business out of Vermont, no problem.
No problem. No, I mean, if you can do your business out of Alaska, you can pretty much do it out of Siberia or anywhere else.
Now, you write travel books, too?
I haven't written travel books, per se. I did a show called Travels on America's Historic Trails, for PBS, which was a lot of fun. And we traveled these historic trails all over the country, including the old Post Road up the East Coast, which
wow.
I enjoyed very much. I love history. It was a terrific project to do. And then another writer turned that into a travel book. It often gets credited to me. It's probably, of all the books that I've written, that's probably the best one, and I didn't write it.
Mm. What's the best one you did write?
Well, that's like picking a favorite child, which, you know, admit it, if you're a parent, you can do that.
Well, the books don't quite speak up the way the kids do.
Well, I have two favorites. Actually, my last book that I published was a young adult novel called Norman Tuttle on the Last Frontier, which I like very much. And the one before that was written for even younger readers called Willowaw, and it's an adventure story of two young Alaskan kids, a brother and a sister, who are like 10 and 11 years old, and how they endure their lives on a bay not unlike the one I lived on for 20 years. And then before that, I have a lot of humorous fiction and stories, and I like it all, but it's kind of like, you know, if you're a storyteller at all, and I know you are, Mark, there's no way you can be on the radio and not be a very accomplished BSer. Is, you got to rotate your stories out. You're not telling the same ones you were 10 years ago. And so that's kind of what happens when you publish books, is you look at the ones you published 20 years ago, and you just feel like a different guy wrote those things. So I tend to always like the most recent stuff because they seem to be the closest to who I am these days.
Huh. So did Norman Tuttle get lost in the woods when he was out on the last frontier?
Yeah, well, you know what he did. He fell off the opening story, and I don't mind revealing this, spoiler alert, because nobody's going to buy it anyway, right? He fell off his dad's fishing boat, and nobody saw him fall off. And he ended up finding a piling from an old abandoned cannery, and there's a lot of these little places around the Alaska coast. And as the tide goes out, he manages to get up on top of this piling, and he's sitting there and at the end of it, like 20 feet out of the water, and the whole time just, you know, heart-wrenchingly going through his sour relationship with his father. And it's probably the most Freudian thing I've ever done.
I was going to ask you.
Yeah, no, yeah. I know. I mean, it's just like, it's so obvious.
Yeah.
It's just, I put in the margin of the book, see the metaphor, you know, in this big yellow tag. There.
Highlight. You had to highlight. You already pre-highlighted the book.
Right. Just in case there's anybody who didn't finish the sixth grade English class.
So tell me about your dad.
My dad?
Yeah.
Well, he's dead.
Yeah.
He's not up to much these days.
All right. Well, tell me what he was like growing up.
My dad was, he was a classic greatest generation guy. He Grew up poor in Chicago, joined the Navy right out of high school, went and fought in the big war, went to college on the GI Bill, was a mechanical engineer, you know, married a beautiful woman, had six kids, worked at the same company for 30 years, retired, lost his memory, got old, and died. I mean, that, it's so unfortunate, wow, isn't it? You can take a man's life and sum it up in about those five sentences, but those are the details of his life. The heart and soul of his life is something altogether different. But he felt like a very accomplished man in what he was able to do with his life.
Hmm. Tell me about your mom.
My mom was that beautiful sweetheart. She grew up in Kewaunee, Illinois. Her father owned a dairy, the Little Gem Dairy, that she used to help him deliver the milk with in the mornings. She was the first woman accepted to the University of Illinois School of Veterinary Medicine. And then she met my father, this handsome naval officer, going to college on the GI Bill. And that was the end of her plans to be a veterinarian. But she and this Navy man went off and started having children. She went to work when I was probably in the fifth or sixth grade, working at a local bank as the bookkeeper. And she rose up through there, and Florence Baudette was well known in the banking circles of Sturgis, Michigan.
Six kids, isn't that? I mean, the irony of Motel 6. Just I can't ignore it.
You're as clumsy with a metaphor as I am, Mark.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that. What a compliment coming from you. All right. So, what's the key to being a good? You know, I'm going to ask you this question. So, what's the key to being a good storyteller? I guess maybe / being a good BS artist.
Yeah. Well, I think and the Moth really has perfected this. They're the best editors I ever had. I went to them with a story about going to Alaska, and they turned it into an amazing story. I always thought it was a good story. They actually made it interesting. And here's what it is you got to strip out all the crap. The Moths, I don't want to say that's their motto, but their mission is it's true stories told live, no notes.
Mm-hmm.
And what I have learned is if I'm going to get out on stage with something, and I do this with everything now, whether I'm talking to a corporate group, a group of writers, an ad group, whatever, is just decide beforehand what I'm going to talk about and go out there and talk about it. Because once I write it down, then it's a matter of just recitation. And if you're reciting something, or people even sense that you're just reciting something, then it becomes theater, and theater can be good. I mean, you go to a play, and these are actors down there. They've memorized their lines, and they're doing a good job of selling them. But it's not the same thing as when they turn to the audience and they tell you something true.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what makes a story, is look somebody in the face and tell them something true about you. And that connects in a way that nothing else does. And that's why I think the Moth and this storytelling movement is gaining such popularity, because I believe that we're kind of starved for that in our lives now. As connected as we appear to be with all of our digital media and all of this, we are still organic creatures. And I don't think we get enough of what I just described, which is someone just looking us in the face and telling us something they know or something that happened to them.
Well, yeah, that tradition of oral history, I mean, it really is fascinating.
And it's crazy how it's... I'm not sure if this is true, but I was told that on any given night in New York City, there are 800 storytelling venues available.
Wow,
they're
really?
All over the place. The Moth has slams all the time. There's all these branch organizations. People have done stuff like what we've done with The Hatch, where we... just taking some of it's, you know, these storytellers move seamlessly between these different venues. Some of them are specialized to, like, science geeks. Some of them are for the medical community. And what would explain that? It's almost, you know, it's like this movement. It's a craving. And I what I compare it to is like the arts and crafts, furniture and architect movement of the turn of the 20th century when... or they say the end of the 19th century, you know, it was a reaction to this gilded age where everything was just too much. It was over the top and over-designed, over everything. And And there was this movement just to get simple again. Let's just build simple furniture that people might be able to construct themselves, simple houses that are approachable by anyone. And that's what I think the storytelling movement is. I think it's a reaction to this gilded digital lives that we've found ourselves living.
Wow, that's really interesting. We're talking with Tom Bodette. He's one of the organizers of an event happening Saturday night at the Flynn Theater up in Burlington. It's a storytelling event called The Hatch. And flynntix.org is how you can get tickets to it. I have just a couple of other questions. You've been really patient with me. I appreciate it. Let me take a call here from Cabot. Tony, good morning.
Good morning. You know what I find amazing about this is that we kind of overlook the fact that everybody has stories. You know, when we're walking around town and we're part of a crowd there, we're just going about our business, and we kind of lose track of the fact that there are stories everywhere. I do some freelance writing, and when I'm in the process of gathering a story together, there it's like dropping a pebble in a pond. The other possibilities come up. They're endless. And so you've got people who've lived lots of years to only a few years, but they all have stories, and it's a wonderful thing. And so this kind of opportunity is something that lets people explain those stories to other folks.
Hmm. All right.
Tom? Yeah, I think, Tony, I think, you know, that is exactly true. And people who are familiar with the Moth and the stories that we've done, you know, the stories aren't necessarily people who are on, you know, the Shackleton expedition. you know, it might just be the story of someone who helped their mom through cancer, or who grew up without having a lot of friends. We've got on Saturday night, we've got Adam Wade, who grew up in New Hampshire. He is just the most amazing storyteller. And all of his stories are these simple little remembrances from his youth and his life that he packs so much meaning into that you'd have to be made of wood not to feel it. And Peter Aguero, another one, we've had him back. Now, this will be the third time Peter's been back. Unbelievable stuff. And again, it's not about, you know, scaling Mount Everest at all. It might be about a fist fight he got in on a frozen pond when he was 13 years old.
And here in Cabot, they're doing something in the schools. I don't know how often they do it, but they have the children go out into the community, and Cabot is a small town, you know, small village, and they collect the stories, and then they write about them. So there's that connectedness that those stories seem to strike a harmonic chord in the listeners, you know.
Thank you, Tony. Appreciate your call. 244-1777, toll-free 877-291-8255. That was a better analogy he had than I did, wasn't it? That pebble in the pond thing?
It's very true, and you know, because story breeds story. I mean, anybody who's ever sat around a campfire, that's why we used a campfire on the poster for this event. You know, someone will tell some stupid story, and then that reminds the next person. It'll go all the way around the fire in that way. And that's what happens at these storytelling events. Now, the Moth does two kinds of shows. One is the main stage, which is what we sort of imitate with our show, where we get five or six storytellers that are prearranged, and they come out there with stories that we know in advance what they're going to do. And then they do these slams. And I know there's a regular slam going on in Burlington right now, and I wish I could plug it with the location, but I don't know what it is offhand. But look that up, the Moth Story Slams in Burlington. And these are people, they show up, and when you walk in the door, you throw your name in the hat, and if they pull your name, you get to tell a story. And what you see if you've ever been to a slam is there might not be that many names in the hat when it starts off, but as soon as a couple stories are told, suddenly people are thinking, hey, I could do this. I got a story. That reminds me of this. And they go and they'll drop their name in the hat. It is absolutely ripples in a pond.
Well, that's when you slap your hand on your forehead and you go, I was on the Shackleton expedition. I have something to talk about.
But you know what I found, and this is kind of to Tony's point as well, that everybody has a story. My first story for the Moth, I had this really self-aggrandizing tale of how I went out west and got hurt really badly in this accident, and then, you know, mustered my courage and fearlessly went to the last frontier where I spent, you know, a good part of my life. And that was the story I wanted to tell because it just seemed so darn, you know, interesting. And in the course of telling that story to one of their directors, I mentioned this letter that my father had written to me right after I got out of the hospital in Oregon where I'd been hurt. And in it, he just was saying that he was proud of me and glad I was okay and that, you know, hoped that I would take care of myself. And my father, being who he was and the engineer that he was, had never done anything even remotely like that. And when I said that to this director, I don't recall that I'd ever mentioned that to anyone before. It just happened to occur to me.
Wow.
And my throat kind of, you know, I felt emotion, and she heard the emotion in my throat. So she let me finish my whole self-aggrandizing story. And the first thing she said when I was done was, tell me more about your father. And that story ended up being, and it is on the Moth website now, if anybody would like to see it or hear it. That story became far more about my relationship with my father and what he did for me with that letter. And I didn't even get to Alaska in that story.
Wow.
So that's, you know, so going back to your original question, Mark, what makes a good story? That's it. Find the nut that made the whole rest of the thing happen. And it may not, and probably often is not, the thing that you think it is.
Wow. Geez, I asked about your dad 15 minutes ago, and you didn't give me that good a story in response.
I was working back to it.
Wow, what a story. Roy Blunt Jr. is going to be there, too. Tell people who he is. He's great.
One of my personal heroes. Roy Blunt Jr., he's been writing, oh, my God, he was one of the editors of Atlantic Magazine for probably, you know, 30, 35 years ago. An amazing storyteller and writer. A true scholar. He's like this southern gentleman. I love this, the author Anne Rice, who you probably would know, said about Roy that, you know, Roy can go into the grocery store for a jar of aspirin and he'll come out with a story. And I read a thing that Roy had written in Atlantic Magazine, oh, God, this is probably over 25 years ago. And I'm not one to write fan letters, but I was so moved by this very, very funny story of his. And it was about storytelling, that I just wrote him a fan letter, basically saying how much I love that story and how much I got out of it. And being who he was, he wrote me back, and I was just this, you know, nowhere guy building houses in Alaska at the time. And years later, then, when Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR weekend show that I'm a part of, called and asked me to be on the panel, wouldn't you know that Roy Blunt Jr. was on the very first panel with me? And, you know, I felt like I was meeting, you know, Muhammad Ali or something. And what's even sweeter is some years after that, this was just 2 years ago, Roy joined me here in Brattleboro for the Brattleboro Literary Festival, which is this wonderful lit fest we do here every fall. And we shared a stage together and did readings of our own work and then talked about it with the audience. And he read, at my request, that story that I had written him about all those years ago.
Huh.
So you were saying, you know, that you feel like you've won the life lottery. Well, I think I have over and over again, because things like this continue to happen for me.
Let me take one more call, let you go. We go to Barry. Hi, Philo. Good morning.
Yes, good morning, Mark. I have a question for your guest. I'm not sure if he can answer it or not, but I'm trying to figure out what this is a benefit for, and if it's the way I'm thinking what it's for, why is it any different than Nature Conservancy and some of these other organizations that have moved into Vermont?
All right, good question.
This is a question with substance. Holy smokes.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, I'm glad he asked it. Did he say he's calling from Mount Philo?
No, his name is Philo.
Oh, Philo. Oh, I'm sorry. I misheard. The way it's different, this is just like there is the National Parks Foundation, which is a private foundation which raises private money to help the national parks. Many states have these state park foundations, essentially, and that's what Vermont Parks Forever is. And the Vermont state parks are almost completely self-supporting. 95% of their budget is paid with non-tax dollars, 65% from fees,
user fees and the ski areas that use them. And I should say that's 95%. And then 5% of their budget is general fund taxes. They have almost 1 million visitors every year. About 60% of those are Vermonters. And what the foundation is, the foundation that I'm a part of, wants to do, we're not about, he mentioned the land conservation, Vermont Land Trust, and things. This is not about necessarily conserving lands or anything like that. It's by furthering the mission of the Vermont State Parks to make them more accessible to people who perhaps aren't getting into the parks for various reasons, whether that's cost or transportation, to make the park experience more educational, to make it a more intimate and meaningful experience. And the parks are a really, really well-run organization. Their director, Craig Whipple, I think that's his title, director. It might be czar, I'm not sure. El Capitan, I think, is what he likes to be called.
Head Ranger.
Right, there it is, Head Ranger. And my apologies to Craig, who I know is listening and cringing. But it's a very well-run organization. But, you know, they're on a tight budget, as any good public agency should be. And what the Vermont Parks Forever wants to be able to do is to augment their tight budget and be able to improve these experiences, make the visitor experience better with more educational materials, perhaps getting more school kids into the parks, to get doctors to actually prescribe parks as a way to get kids out in nature and tackle this syndrome that actually has a name now, nature deficit disorder, which I'm not exactly sure what that means, but I think it's an inability to be able to go to the bathroom in the woods. Don't quote me on that. But.
Need a little time in Alaska, apparently. Yeah. So are you going to be telling a story at this event?
Yes, I'm going to be hosting. So I will be telling some a few tales throughout. My main job is to make everybody else look good, and yeah. I hope to do that as well. But I will definitely be sharing some of my outdoor stories as well.
Well, I'm glad Philo called, because I'm glad you got at least one meaty question.
Right. Speaking of meaty, we've talked around a couple of our storytellers. There's not time enough to go into all of them, because they're all so great. Ophira Eisenberg, who's the host of Ask Me Another on NPR, and she's just terrific. We mentioned Adam Wade and Peter Aguero, and Roy Blunt, but we also have Kevin Hand, who's a local boy, grew up in Manchester, Vermont. And he is an astrobiologist. He works for the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and his job is looking for life on other worlds. And he got his love of that, his curiosity about what's going on out there in the universe, laying on his back on the Vermont landscape, looking up at the Vermont skies. And he is going to be our first storyteller on the show. And tell us how that came to be. And I just think that is such a powerful recommendation, if you will, of why our parks should be there and the kinds of things that they can allow people to pursue. It's not just about going and roasting marshmallows over a fire. You can build an entire life on an experience you have in a state park.
Wow, that's powerful, Tom. Wow. Parks where the stories begin. That's a freebie. You can use that.
Yeah, go ahead.
I know it's not as good as Leave the Light On, but, you know, it's the best thing I could come up with off the top of my head.
I know, and it's early, Mark.
It is early. Thank you very much for your time this morning. I really enjoyed our chat.
Well, I did, too. Thanks for letting me ramble on, Mark. I appreciate your time.
Tom Beaudet is the voice of Motel 6, who lives down in Dummerston, and he's going to be the organizer of this event coming up Saturday night at the Flynn Theater. It's an event called The Hatch. It is essentially a storytelling event. Any of you familiar with The Moth are pretty familiar with what they're doing. I don't think we've really promoted enough stuff on NPR here this morning, though. Oh, speaking of which, by the way, I was kindly invited to tomorrow participate in the roundtable discussion on Bob Kinzel's show over at Vermont Public Radio, Vermont Edition at noontime. So I appreciate the invitation, which I accepted. You know, it must be payback for having John Dillon on here. Just kidding. Now, we're all, you know, what I'm trying to do is encourage people in the media to recognize that there are so few of us left that if we spend too much time fighting with each other, that we need to be fighting against, fighting for truth and justice in the American way instead of fighting with each other. So this is all part of my, you know, all part of my diplomatic effort that's going on out there. All right, we're going to take a short commercial break. First, let me remind you about our good friends at Green Mountain Access. If you're looking for an outstanding local internet service provider, make it our friends at gmavt.net. You can call them toll-free at 1-888-321-0815. And they're on the web at gmavt.net. An outstanding tech support team. They're really great people to work with. And just great customer service in general. Division of Waitsfield and Champlain Valley Telecom. Give them a call today. 1-888-321-0815. And on the web at gmavt.net.
Formula Nissan in Barrie is the fastest growing Nissan dealer.